on the phone with Baba, does not want to explain how even a casual dinner at her home could anger her father, so she silences the phone. To explain would be to point out that she is a woman and he is a man, that it is a Friday night, that they are alone. What she first liked about Tariq when they met semesters ago was how she did not feel self-conscious in his presence. He had taken a seat next to her by chance, glanced over at her notes, and commented on how they were unreadable to him, but clearly organized. He studied her face for a moment. "I know you," he said then. "You're the one with the sharp questions." When he asked her if she wanted to meet outside of class, it was not for coffee or dinner, but to study together at the library. It was never easy with men. Not easy talking to them, not easy thinking she could love them. Any interest made her nervous, mistrustful even. But she and Tariq had been friends for months before Hadia decided it was in her hands to reach for more if she wanted it, to call him over for dinner, to make plans intentionally once their excuse of studying together was gone. Baba calls again, and again she does not answer. Tariq stands to clear the plates, and Hadia tries to concentrate on the story he is telling her. But she pictures Amar, the last time she saw him months ago. That tear in the seam of his jacket. His incoherent mumbling at the edge of their driveway. It could be bad news. She tells Tariq she will be right back, steps into her bedroom, and closes the door behind her. Takes a seat on the floor of her closet, surrounded by clothes that will muffle her voice. "Hadia," Baba answers right away. Something in his voice. How a voice is different if one has just woken up or lying down, but it is not that. She sits up straight. "When are you coming home?" She does not have a trip planned. She has been trying to assert herself by setting the pattern of her own life, hoping her parents will grow to accept it. "I'm not sure yet, Baba. Why?" "Can you come soon?" "My next break is in 3 weeks." Baba is quiet for so long, she wonders if he has heard her.
"I don't know what to do."
His voice quavers. She digs her nails into the carpet of her closet. He has never spoken this way, not these words, and certainly not with this tone.
"What do you mean?"
"Something has happened. He's not going to his classes."
"This is normal for Amar, remember? He'll sign up again next semester." Her delivery does not even convince her. She stares up into the dark sleeves of her hanging shirts.
"He never leaves the house. Or he goes missing for days. And then he's back, sleeping in his bedroom again. I try to wake him at midday, and he does not wake up."
The four pills in his jacket pocket. She closes her eyes, leans back against the closet wall.
"Have you searched his things?"
Silence. And then,
"If you can come home."
"What would I do, Baba?"
"You could talk to him. He trusts you."
After she hangs up the phone, she steps into the living room. Tariq looks up at her.
"What's wrong?" he asks immediately.
She has never lost her composure in front of him before. "I have to go home."
"Now?"
It is a 5-hour drive, and it is already 11 at night. Tariq's concern appears genuine. He has been so open with her. Maybe she will allow herself to become closer to him than she has been to anyone. But how can she be certain he will not look unkindly at her family?
"Do you want me to come with you?"
he asks. He is good-hearted. She is grateful. She lifts her purse and grabs her keys and shakes her head no. The sky is pale by the time she arrives. In a daze, she enters her house, and at this hour, even the furniture appears at peace. Sofas draped with white sheets, the plants growing in their pots by the staircase, the shoes left by the door. No one knows she has come. Even she had not known she would, until after she hung up with Baba, saying to him, "Well, maybe you should talk to him without anger and he would trust you too," which she regretted saying. Not because she did not mean it, but because, instead of calling her Battamiz, Baba had gone quiet. He had been slow to respond throughout the conversation, and then he only said, "Yes, well, if you could come." Once she is home, she heads straight to Amar's bedroom, and he is there, fast asleep, his window wide open and cold air rushing in. All night she drove in a steady panic, not knowing what it had been like at home, not knowing if she was arriving too late. She does not know if her body is dizzy from the lack of sleep and excess caffeine, or from the immense relief at the sight of her brother. She shuts his window, sits at the edge of his bed. A faint memory, the light gray, and Amar telling her that Hadia would always come for him if he called. "Thank you, God," she thinks. "Maybe I have been selfish, but you have allowed me to return before it was too late." She feels strange after the thought. It is how her mother would think to thank God. And Hadia considers her relationship to God to be slightly more sophisticated than her mother's. But if God is the one to thank, then she will thank him. And she stands from the bed and kneels on the floor, touches her forehead to the carpet. In the garden, Hadia leans against the plum tree, and Amar sits by her, pulling grass from the ground and dropping it like confetti. This time of year, the plums are still small and bitter. Every once in a while, her mother's face appears at a window. But when Hadia looks again, her mother is gone. Usually, being around her siblings is like returning to her original self, with no need to think of what to say or how to say it. But today, she is hesitant. She is trying to get a sense of what the problem might be, or gauge the extent of it. But any time she circles close to asking Amar directly, she retreats, afraid to anger him or lose his trust. "I didn't mean for it to be like this," he confesses.
"Like what, Amar?"
"I can't describe it."
"Try."
"I know you don't trust me."
"I trust you."
He plucks blades of grass, then lines them up on his palm. "I owe somebody money."
"What did you do?"
"I know you don't trust me, Hadia."
"I do, Amar."
"Who do you owe? For what?" $500. He flips his palm, and some of the blades fall to the ground. Others stick to his skin, and he shakes his hand. She rests her forehead against her palm.
"That's a lot.
Will you help me?"
He's not looking at her. "I don't have that kind of money."
"You're a doctor."
"I'm still a student."
She tries to hide the hurt from her voice. "I'll pay you back. I know you don't think I will, but I will."
"I know you will."
"You do?"
He looks up. His eyes are wide. He is still like a child.
He has not cut his hair in months, and it falls into his face. She only saw him recently, and she is alarmed by how much weight he has lost. His cheeks are sunken, and his cheekbones even more pronounced. Is she a fool to trust her brother because he is her brother? Against her own instincts, her own intuition, because she wants to believe him, because she has known him his whole life, and cannot fathom a change so drastic he would be made unfamiliar to her.
"I do."
"Don't tell Baba," he asks her.
Don't you trust me?
I do. I knew I could ask you.
A needle, Baba had said earlier that morning, when she first spoke to him alone in the hallway while everyone slept. Baba hugged her, and she braced against his embrace, realized in that moment that she did not trust him when it came to Amar. He agreed, almost too eagerly, to let her speak to him first. He could not control his anger, and Amar could not control his reaction to it. And they found themselves in unpredictable territory.
I don't understand how he could sin so severely, Baba had whispered, shaking his head.
Baba, sinning does not even matter anymore. Not in the face of this.
She was speaking with such little patience. Baba blinked at her. Hadia sensed a new space opening between them, a space in which he looked to her for answers, and realized she could say anything. Was it respect that allowed Baba to listen to her now, or desperation? Right and wrong, halal and haram, it was her father's only way of experiencing the world. She should do what she could to bridge the distance between his understanding and Amar's actions.
Baba, what he is gambling on is not just his standing before God. This is much graver. This is about him surviving this life here.
She had never seen her father so bewildered, so helpless. And she found herself not wanting to protect his weakness, as she might have hoped, but wanting to attack it, wanting him to blame himself the way she faulted him.
You cannot approach him now as you always have, she said.
Tell me how.
You cannot get angry. It will only make everything worse.
Baba lowered his face and nodded. Huda is reading in her bedroom when Hadia steps in. Hadia says nothing as she crawls into Huda's bed, lays her head in her sister's lap, curls her legs up close to her chest, and tucks her hand between her knees. Huda rests her hand on Hadia's shoulder, and its weight is comforting. Huda's breathing somehow calms her. Hadia closes her eyes and listens to the sound of pages turning. It might be just the two of us from now on. The thought comes to her just like that, and the force of her grief at having thought it surprises her.
Is this what was always going to happen? Hadia asks.
Huda does not have to ask her to explain. She runs her hand through Hadia's hair in the exact way she always wanted Mama to, and what is clenched tight in Hadia breaks, and somehow she is crying. Huda speaks at last.
I think at some point it could have been different for him, for us, but now, I don't know.
What point? The sound of Mama watering the lawn drifts in through the open window, and Hadia pictures Mama covering the green hose with four fingers so the spray fans out.
I always thought Amar stopped trying after the shoes. His attitude to Baba was different. He stopped calling him Baba. That was the year he was held back, remember? He stopped wanting to want anything at all.
It comes at once, and so vividly. The posters, the petition, the speech, the spelling test. Amar kicking his legs back and forth, seated at her desk, biting the yellow pencil until the paint chipped off. The rest of the house fast asleep as Hadia held the banister, stepped into the dark downstairs, and knocked against the door of Baba's office. Huda continues. After that, I noticed his pattern. He begins to try, only to feel at some point helplessly unable to continue. Like he decides for himself, there is no point in trying. The curtain moves back and forth. The fabric of Huda's trousers are wet from her tears. Mama turns off the hose.
You're going to make a good teacher,
Hadia says to her. And Huda mouths a thank you and wipes Hadia's cheeks. How were they to know the moments that would define them? It will affect his personality for his whole life, someone is saying to her. And whose fault will it be then? Mine, a voice replies. And the voice is hers. Now her brother was in danger of having nothing. And now she wanted nothing her brother could not have. Not the exams her teachers handed back to her winking. Not the accolades. Not the watch that had been gifted to her. She was glad it had disappeared. Not the career she was building, or the space opening up between her and Baba that told her he finally respected her as an adult and would rely on her the way a father might a son. What had she done to her brother? So that she could survive, so that she could be the one who thrived. She is in the living room when she hears the arguing, Amar and Baba, though she can't make out their words. She sets her mug down. She had told Baba he could not get angry. She had made it absolutely clear. They needed to proceed carefully, thoughtfully. She looks back at Mama, who has been preparing dinner in the kitchen. And Mama has also heard. They meet each other's gaze, and it is clear neither knows if they should run upstairs and separate them. Mama sets down the bowl, massages the back of her neck. Then there is the sound of a loud crash, the thud of a body hitting a wall, a human noise that chills her, because it sounds so animal. Then glass crunching. And another crash Hadia imagines is a frame falling to the floor. Hadia thinks she will be sick. Mama rushes past Hadia and up the stairs, and Hadia stands absolutely still, not wanting to climb the steps and look her father in the eye. Not now, that he has revealed himself to be a man who cannot control his anger, even in the face of so fragile a moment. When she finally does climb the stairs, Baba is standing in the hallway, a dazed look on his face. Amar's chest is heaving. He stares unfocusedly at the carpet, all the scattered glass. She was right. It had been the sound of the large frame falling to the floor. Mama kneels to pick up the shards of glass, drops them one by one into her cupped hand. Mama is the only one who speaks. Her voice so hoarse and unsteady, it frightens Hadia. Enough of this now. I've had enough. It is almost dawn when she is woken by the sound of a closet door being opened and the creak of Amar's floor. What are you doing? She whispers when she opens his door and sees him, though it is clear what he is doing. He grabs shirts and jeans. He discards some clothes on the floor and throws others into a black duffel bag. After he has finished rummaging through the drawers, from bottom to top, and left them open like a thief, he takes a step back, rests one hand on his neck, and scans his room, as if checking what else to take.
You know I can't stay here anymore. He speaks with his back to her.
She shuts the door gently behind her, intending to reach out and touch his shoulder, pick up the clothes from the floor, and return them to the drawers. But she stops herself. What surprises her is that this is a moment she recognizes. Not that she has seen this sight, but that maybe she has always feared that one day this is how he would react, that there would come a time when there were words exchanged and actions executed that neither he nor their father could recover from. And maybe there is a part of her, cruel and unforgiving, that has been waiting for Amar to realize what she has sensed all along, that there is no place for him in their home. Amar looks wildly around the room. He is trembling. Very soon it will be time for Fajr. Just a day ago, She had returned at this hour and thanked God for the sight of him sleeping. Now she wonders if she was called home not to intervene, but to say goodbye. She takes a seat on Amar's unmade bed, pulls a pillow toward her, and wraps her arms around it. Amar kneels on the floor and zips his duffel bag. He puts on the jacket with the ripped inside pocket. He grabs his backpack, steps up to his window, and touches the surface of his windowsill. When he finally turns away, he takes a seat beside her. They do not speak. He seems at this moment so much taller than she.
Tell them I went for a run if they ask.
Only Amar would think a lie like that would be believed. Her pride, or fear, keeps her from asking when he will return.
At night, if they ask where I am, tell them I'm staying at a friend's house for a few days. When they want to look for me, tell them I've left. I've moved. I'm not coming back. I'm sorry, Hadia. But can you do this for me?
She will come up with what to tell them herself. But even so, she repeats his steps. Gone for a run. Gone to a friend's house. Gone to a new city. Moved. Not coming back. Leaving them. Leaving her.
Hadia, he says,
and his hand grips the strap of his backpack so tightly, it looks like he's forming a fist. She shakes her head. She does not want to hear his explanation, does not want to be convinced he is right to do this.
What are you waiting for? If you're really going to go.
She speaks so sharply she surprises herself. And it has worked. She has hurt him. But there is something about the determined look in his eyes that hurts her more. Something that tells her he is serious. That there will be no dissuading him. Once she glimpses her fear, she follows it to its worst conclusion, and now she wonders, what if this is the last time I see my brother?
We both know what it is you're doing, she says kindly this time. Do you think leaving will help you? That if you leave, you can have a healthier...
She stops. She had thought his face would harden, but he considers her words.
I don't know, he says honestly. But if I stay, I'll only continue to hurt them.
He watches her profile. Soon the dark outside will begin to blue. You should go before they wake for Fajr, she whispers. Amar nods. He has been waiting for her to give him permission. Her words are enough for him to know she will do what he has asked of her. He stands and lifts his duffel bag. You have a plan? She asks. A place in mind?
I'll be okay.
She has no more money to offer him.
You will call me? If you ever need anything?
He nods and twists his mouth. He looks like a boy afraid, having made a decision he does not know how to execute. He stands in the doorway with his backpack hanging over one shoulder.
If I could make myself change, Hadia, I would. If I could be like you or Huda, if I had a choice, I would change in an instant.
I know, Amar.
I know it is hard for them, but it is hard for me too.
Maybe it will be easier where you're going. Or maybe it will get easier for all of us in a few months, or years. He smiles a little. She does too. Then they are quiet again. She can tell he's stalling, that there is something he's trying to find the words for.
You'll take care of them?
He finally asks. She knows what he is asking of her, to be there for their parents, not only in the aftermath of his departure, but also in the distant future. And isn't this exactly what she had wanted as a girl? To be the one they depended on, for there to be no difference between daughters and sons? Now she cannot even look at him as she nods. She blinks and blinks and refuses to let herself cry. She tells herself that when he leaves, she will not go to the window as she has before. Will not want to watch him get into whichever car has come for him, knowing he hasn't asked her to leave his window open. She'll fall asleep in his bed, and Amar will continue on with the friend she doesn't know. On his way to the city, he doesn't offer to name. There is no time for him to walk out beneath the Quran, and she does not know if he would even care to. But still, she steps forward, raises her finger a little, and asks, "May I?" He nods. He ducks a little so she can reach, and then closes his eyes. She traces it slowly, tries to get the Arabic exactly right, wishes she knew the prayer her mother would whisper to accompany the gesture. He does not flinch. He looks peaceful, even. "Please, God," she begins her own prayer. 9. Weeks after their meeting in the tunnel, Amar steps from a party into the basement for a moment alone. He has not heard from Amira in almost 3 weeks. Every day he had awoken hopeful that she would break the silence, but by night, he had known. In the basement, he watches a man lift and lower a credit card so fast it is like he is mincing dust, then sweeping coke into a swift and delicate line. And Amar is alarmed by the sudden presence of a thought. "I'll try anything just to not feel this way anymore." He knows then that if he does not try to win Amira back, she will be lost to him, and he too will be terrifically lost. Upstairs, the music is so loud he can feel the beat in his stomach. People are dancing in the dark, smelling of sweat, and he walks past them all until he finds Kyle, their designated driver. "Can you drive me somewhere?" Amar asks him, and he even says please.
"Tell me this is not about her," Kyle says. All of his friends refer to Amira as her.
They know not to say anything negative, but they have made their opinions clear too, that Amar and Amira would never work.
"Who else?" Amar says. Kyle shakes his head. "I told you, she's not good news. Just stay here."
The song changes. People from the other room cheer. The beat thrums in his body.
"Fine," Amar says. "I'll ask Simon."
He starts to walk away. Kyle grabs his arm and holds him back.
"Simon's no good either. Come on."
They walk out into the night. Kyle has eyes like a deer, and maybe this is why Amar had trusted him almost immediately. Kyle and Simon were childhood friends, but lately they had begun to drift apart. Kyle thought Simon was being reckless by using and selling painkillers. Simon had even offered to supply Amar, but Amar had shaken his head. "Whiskey and weed's enough for me," he had said. "I don't need anything fancy." Now he steps into Kyle's navy car, and Amar gives him directions. He leans his heavy head against the window.
"Look, I have loved Simon like a brother for years, but I don't like him anymore. He's always been kind of an idiot."
"You're not an idiot, Amar. We all know that.
But if a decent guy follows an idiot, what does that make him?"
"Thanks for the compliment," he mumbles, reading the names of streets until they become familiar. But something about Kyle's words strikes a nerve. It reminds him of a saying of Imam Ali that his mother taught him, about how important it was for one to choose the right friends,
that it was one's friends who were the truest reflection of the self.
It's obvious you love her, and I'm sorry your heart is breaking.
Really, I am.
But you can't just show up at her house at this hour.
You're going to scare her.
And you might not remember telling me, but you've said it to me before, that she wants someone straight edge and religious. Look at you, man. You say it's hard enough for you to chill with your family. How are you ever going to chill if you end up with a girl like that?
They are close to her home. He sits up in his seat, and the seat belt stretches.
I'm driving you all this way. The least you can do is listen to me, Kyle says.
I'm listening, he snaps. But I don't expect you to understand. When I'm with her, it's like I can live that life. I can be that guy. It's like I want to. I don't want this. I don't care about any of this.
Amar can't expect Kyle to understand, because he can't quite understand it either. All he knows is that if he were with her, he could be Muslim. He could try his best to practice, if practicing meant trying, failing, and then resolving to try again. Sometimes he suspected that it was not her he was fighting for, so much as what life with her would represent and promise him. A respectable life. A daughter-in-law his parents would beam at. Sure, he could not see eye to eye with his parents now, but with Amira, he could grow into that practicing believer. He could have children and take them to the Sunday school, make the weekly trip to the mosque, show his face at the community events, roll out prayer rugs, never stock their refrigerator with beer. If she were the one he would wake up next to, he would do it all. And eventually, he imagined, his father might even respect him. He felt like a dam waiting to break open, and he wanted her, unfairly maybe, to keep him contained.
Do you have any gum? He asks.
Kyle sighs loudly, then tosses him a tin of mints. Amar drops mints into the center of his palm, pops them in his mouth, and then bites down on all four.
Just look at yourself, Kyle grumbles. She's going to know. It's 1 a.m. and your eyes are all red, for God's sake.
He flinches at the mention of God. He hates if he's high or drunk and someone begins talking about religion. And tonight is the 8th of Muharram. He had wanted to make a point to his family, had not gone with them to mosque on purpose. But now, the realization that he's drunk on so important a night almost makes him panic. He pops another mint into his mouth, crushes it with his teeth, breathes into his cupped hand, and tries to sniff for any scent of whiskey. They are approaching her neighborhood, and he tells Kyle to slow down.
Holy shit, Kyle says. She lives here?
Amar nods sullenly. Kyle whistles.
You didn't tell me your girl was a queen. Don't ever bring Simon here, he says darkly.
Amar is too nervous to ask why not. At the party, when he knew he was coming, Amar sent Amira a quick message to tell her he would knock on her front door if he had to. He would sleep in her backyard until morning. He would aim tiny pebbles at the rectangle of her bedroom window, like every fool in every foolish movie. She had to speak to him. She had to see him. Just once more, he begged. And then he swore to never bother her again, if that is what she truly wanted. Amar steps out of the car, but before he shuts the door, Kyle ducks his head through the window and says,
Good luck, man. I might give you a hard time, but I'm rooting for you.
It's not until he feels his face go numb in the cold air that it occurs to him how much he has had to drink. He concentrates on keeping his steps steady. He aims mint after mint at her window until a light turns on. When her face appears,
He sparks his lighter and waves the small flame. Amira disappears, and a moment later, her room is dark again. Anything to be able to tell himself he did everything, that he tried again. The sliding door downstairs opens, slowly, announced by the squeak and the reflection of the moon shifting slightly. She walks toward him on tiptoe, barefoot. He did not know his heart could even beat this hard.
"Have you absolutely lost your mind?" she hisses.
She has been crying. Even in the dark, he can see her eyes are puffy and small. For the first time since the tunnel meeting, it occurs to him that maybe she has also been hurting. She looks frail. He reaches for her face and holds it between his hands. She is startled and for a moment silent. He has never been so bold, so abrupt. She does not step back from him.
"They were right," she says. "You're drunk."
"Amira."
"You are."
And her voice is shaking.
"You were never going to change."
It was true. He was drunk. He holds on to her face to steady himself. "I only drank because we're not speaking anymore. I promise I will stop."
"Lie to everyone else, Amar, but don't lie to me. You're being selfish."
He lets go. Only his father had ever called him selfish. He doesn't care what anyone says, but he does care what she says. She takes a step back. He is about to say, "I won't do it again. I don't need to drink. I don't need to smoke. I don't need anything. But I can't lose this." She looks past him to the thicket of trees where they once played hide-and-seek, where he watched her take a drag of her first cigarette. Her arms are crossed and held tight against her body. Then she looks up at him. There is a soft bruise just beneath her eye, but maybe it is just a shadow. When he reaches out to press it carefully with his thumb, she recoils, swats his thumb away from her face like he's a fly.
"Go away, Amar. I'll be in trouble all over again."
"Everyone gives up on me. Give me one more chance." Her feet are pale in this light. This is the very lawn he stood on year after year, pausing while playing soccer to look up, hoping for that glimpse of her.
"Have you been lying to me all these years?" she asks quietly.
He shakes his head.
"Did you really believe you could do this? Become who you needed to be? Send a proposal properly one day?"
He sighs. And then, "I tried harder to do that, be that, than I've tried to do anything before."
"Did you want to?"
"I wanted you."
"But that life, did you want it?"
He says nothing. She nods slowly.
"Do you believe in God?"
she whispers. Her voice is so small. They had asked each other 100 questions. How had they missed this one? He looks from the dewy grass to her bare feet and searches his heart for an answer, his honest one. "Not like this," he says at last. "Not my father's God." He is not sure what he means, but instead of stiffening, her face softens to him.
"Now you don't have to try to pretend."
He was never pretending about wanting to be with her. That was exactly, unequivocally, the one thing he wanted. But he cannot deny the exhalation in him, that he has spoken aloud what he so feared to be true, that he could speak the words and still continue to exist.
"Amar, maybe I've been keeping you from becoming yourself," she says, and he can tell she is being very gentle with him.
He stares at the tops of the trees, black this time of night, and feels how he had that one night years ago, as though he were venturing out from his old world into a new one, where he would be entirely alone.
"Say something," she asks him.
"What will it be like?"
It had been their game, since the note she left on his pillow. One of them would ask the other, "What's it like?" And the other would give a response, never specifying what it was. Tonight he has altered their line. What he wants to know now is how he is going to live without her. She says nothing. She reaches her hand up and touches the side of his face. She has never done this before. She has never initiated touch. The strongest wind through the tallest branches makes a sweeping sound. The longest silence is hers. And then, after a while, after he leans his face into her warm hand, she says to him, bravely and without a hint of uncertainty, "Amar, I know this will mean nothing to you now, but I do believe that even your father's God, even he, would forgive you. To know you is to want to let you in."
"I'm sorry, really I am," Kyle keeps saying as they drive back to the party.
Amar isn't sure what about his demeanor is making Kyle look over at him at every stoplight. Amar is just quiet. Mama had begun to look at him in that way too, like he was disappearing right before her eyes. He had been eating very little and sleeping in very late. Anytime Simon called him with a plan for the night, he agreed without asking any questions. Kyle parks the car, and Amar tells him he wants to stay at the party. He has nowhere else to go. He does not love her any longer. He only loves her. He will leave and never return. He will wait by the door until he is invited inside again. On and on, he thinks in opposite extremes, until he's not sure who he is or what he wants. Once inside, he sinks into the couch beside Simon and the guy from the basement. The dancing is over. People speak slowly and laugh easily in the dim light. He asks the guy from the basement what coke feels like.
"Like flying," he says.
Amar does not care for a thrill. He turns to Simon and flicks one finger against Simon's chest pocket, where Simon keeps the smallest bag of pills.
"What's it like?" he asks.
Simon thinks for a moment.
"Like nothing exists, not even you."
Kyle watches him from the doorway. His eyes are gentle and big. Amar cannot look back at him. He is not quite sure why. He looks instead at the knuckle that he has been kneading with his thumb, the one that is now redder than the rest.
"How much for nothing?"
Simon throws his arm over Amar's shoulder and pulls him close for a moment before letting go.
"For you, my brother? Your first time, nothing will not cost you anything at all."
When he looks back at the doorway, Kyle is gone. Simon drops a round pill in his palm, white and weightless. Amar thinks that at least with this, he is certain there will be no smell. Layla parks in the empty cul-de-sac. And though she knows Amar is in the middle of his chemistry exam, she still looks around before stepping out from the car. Slowly, the Ali house comes into view. The trees surrounding their property sway, so that the house with its balconies and rows of glinting windows stands like a rock in comparison. Every jashan and majlis hosted by the Alis was a production, and it was no effort for Seema. She was calm when the guests arrived, her hands soft, having hired people who did the work and catering for her. sparkling Christmas lights wrapped around every pillar and curved banister during their jashans, and even the trunks of trees that led up to the driveway twinkled. Those nights, it looked like stars had fallen from the sky. Now it looks like any other home. Leila pauses at the edge of the driveway. She had not anticipated feeling anything other than determination. But as she approaches the house, that impulse to tuck the car away, enter and leave without being seen, unnerves her. Seema said she would be home alone, and seemed surprised when Leila wanted to meet. Their friendship was one born of circumstance and routine, and because of this, they rarely met outside of mosque or an event, and never alone. There had been a hint of worry in her voice, and Leila wondered, bitterly, if she was afraid that a proposal would be sent on Amar's behalf for the girl, and Seema would have to bear the discomfort of denying her. The Ali girl received 10 proposals after any event she went to. Seema would complain, in the way that people would, when they wanted to brag, but disguised it as a burden.
"And yet Amira says she's not ready," Seema would say, lifting up her hand in frustration and shaking it. "What has gotten into the girls these days? Saying they're not ready, as if there is something else, something more important they're waiting for, and only after that will they consider marriage."
Leila would give Seema a hollow laugh. Her daughters also received proposals. But the Ali girl was only 18. Leila's daughters were already 23 and 24, and getting older every month. She dreaded the thought of their prospects dwindling as they aged. They insisted not only not yet, but also not him, with no reason given. Every night she prayed God would continue to shower them with the blessing of respectable proposals, and then would immediately pray for her daughters to develop some common sense. What was the use in one if they so lacked the other? An hour ago, she packed walnuts in a clear plastic bag for her son. She sliced a green apple. She filled his water bottle with cold water. "For your test," she said, as she handed him the brown bag. "For you to have energy to do well." He was nervous. She had never seen him so driven, so concerned about his education. The sight of him, with books in the crook of his arm, filled her with pride. Her prayers for him had been answered. He had finally developed ihsas, an understanding of his actions, of the impact of them. She wanted him to do well. She wanted nothing to hinder him from becoming the man she believed he could become. As she wondered what to say to him, she remembered the purple light of an old classroom and Amar's sweet teacher who had succeeded, albeit temporarily, in encouraging him. "Don't worry, it's just a test. As long as you do the best you can, we will be happy." He nodded slowly, considering her words. Then, that dark look of his took over, and he said quietly, "It's not just a test. I have to do well." Leila sighed. She had asked Rafiq to stop pressuring him, and Rafiq, tired of Amar's badtamizi and the hostility between them, had reminded Leila that he only spoke to Amar when it was absolutely necessary. Leila held a Quran above his head as he stepped out the front door for luck and extra confidence. She shielded the sun from her eyes and watched him leave before preparing to drive to Seema's house. He would be affected for a week, a few months, but he would recover. What was the heartache one felt in youth? Nothing but a dream. By the time he was an adult, he would hardly remember it. And what was heartache when compared with public humiliation? Heartache was the quick touch of a flame. But for one's inner life to be gossiped about and judged by the entire community, it was like holding one's hand above fire until it left a scar. She had been stunned and sickened by the contents of Amar's keepsake box. For months, she knew he had been hiding something, smiling to himself whenever his phone buzzed, guarding his phone and barking about privacy if anyone came near him. It was difficult enough to see her son step so willingly towards sin. She imagined it would have been unbearable if her daughters had done the same. How had she failed to pass on to one child what was so instilled in the others? This was the question that haunted her. They had all heard the same speeches, listened to the same stories and lessons, and yet. Layla lifts her fist and knocks. Seema appears before she can exhale. Seema smells faintly of perfume when they embrace, and Layla follows her inside. Instead of the family photos that Layla has hung in her home, the Ali family has decorated their walls with ornate mirrors, purposeless tables, paintings Layla does not find beautiful. Canvases painted blocks of red, stripes of light yellow and black. Layla glimpses her reflection in a mirror as she passes, and for a second, it alarms her. Biscuits have been placed on little plates in the living room, colorful napkins stacked. Seema asks Layla if she would like tea or coffee, and then disappears to prepare it. The house is very quiet. Soon she can hear the faint gurgle of the water boiling, then the whistle. Layla's heart thuds in her chest, and she twists her orni around her finger. Their secret, Amar and Amira's, would come out eventually. If only the surface were considered, it was Amira who would be chastised. It was her innocence that would be compromised. But Layla knew that when the shock of a woman's begrarity subsided, the root of the scandal, the reason why the parents did not just rush to make it a halal match, would be because Amar was not the kind of man worthy of marrying the Ali girl. Once they were bored with the questions of how could she, the more sinister question would rise up to sting Layla. What had she seen in Rafiq and Layla's boy? Seema and Brother Ali would laugh at the proposal if it were to be sent. They would nip it in the bud before word of it even reached their daughter. They had wealth, and they had beauty. They had noble lineage, and the respect of the entire community. So often, someone from their mosque, including Brother Ali, would report to Rafiq that they had seen Amar smoking in the parking lot, or that he had stepped away as soon as the Adhan began, as though the call to prayer called everyone else but repelled him. One man from the community even had the gall to tell her husband that red eyes were the sign of a man who took drugs. They thought they were doing Rafiq a favor, and Rafiq would solemnly thank them. But at night, he would be unable to sleep, and Layla would have to prod him just for him to speak about it. "What can I do, Layla?" Rafiq would ask her helplessly. Layla would be unable to comfort him. Her own spirit had been broken by not being able to deny the rumors. She too was disheartened when her son came home with a sway to his step, smelling strongly of stale cigarette smoke and cheap body spray. If this is what reached Layla and Rafiq, she could only imagine what people whispered among themselves. But what did it matter what moments of the community said when they picked apart the behavior of her son? What was a believer meant to be like when all their rituals and practices were stripped away? Amar was kind. If one of his sisters came home carrying heavy textbooks, he rose to help them before they even asked. He was generous. He had very little of his own money, but still, he would bring home the coffee drinks Huda or Hadia liked, or a bag of cherries for Layla come cherry season, or a candle with a floral scent. Layla gossiped sometimes, everyone did, but she had never heard her son speak ill of anyone. Once when she spoke of someone from their community, he said to her, "You don't know that, Mama. Don't say that if you don't fully know it." her heart had swelled. How her son was good, in a way that she wasn't, in a way that could instruct her. Leila had begun to think lately that there was no real way to quantify the goodness of a person, that religion gave templates and guidelines, but there were ways it missed the mark entirely. And everything a mu'min should be in his heart, Ammar was. Seema sets down the tea for her, and Leila notices she has chosen a mug of coffee for herself. "Are your boys home?" Leila asks. She dips a biscuit in her tea. The crumbs break off and float on the tea's surface.
"No, they've gone out for the afternoon. You know how kids are these days, always going out. Everywhere but their own home is a magnet to them."
Leila removes her scarf. Seema sits across from her on her plush couch, her legs tucked beneath her. She cradles her mug in her hands. Not a single hair on her head is white, and Leila knows she dyes it often. Seema is one of the few women of Leila's generation who chooses not to wear a headscarf. Leila untangles her own unruly strands with her fingers.
"And Amira? Is she home?"
"She's at the library," Seema says.
"The bug of going out has bitten her too. Any excuse they'll give me. Mama, I have to go to get a book from the library. Mama, I have to go and get a haircut. Mama, the haircut lady was closed, so I walked to the cupcake place."
Leila sits back in her seat. She can speak without fear of being overheard. She knew when she glimpsed the contents of Ammar's box that she would meet Seema in person, her words disappearing into the air once they were spoken, untraceable.
"Are you sure?" Leila asks. She traces the rim of the cup with her finger. She knows what she wants, to put an end to what has been brewing between the two, for the end to be swift. The last thing Ammar needs is a young girl tempting him, distracting him from his studies, only to break his heart when a stronger proposal comes.
"What do you mean to say, Leila? Are you accusing me of not knowing where my daughter is?"
The tone of Seema's voice has sharpened, but she still smiles in a pained way. Both of them notice a shift in the air, the room suddenly hostile.
"I only mean that you should keep a closer eye on her."
Seema sets down her coffee mug, its steam still drifting up, and places her feet firmly on the ground. "I found letters and photographs of Amira that she has been sending to my son," Leila begins, keeping her voice steady. "For months, maybe even years." It is clear from the photographs that Ammar has taken them, but she wants to conceal his part. The thought of a young girl sending photographs of herself to a young man is irrefutably inappropriate.
"You should read them. I've never known a girl to have such little sharam."
Seema's mouth is open, and she appears completely shocked. Maybe assessing if Leila is telling the truth. Maybe processing what she had not predicted. Besharam. The word is like a slap. Modesty, the highest value a woman can embody, and the most crucial. Without it, a woman is nothing. They have drilled the importance of it into their daughters since they were little girls, as it was once emphasized to them. Guarded themselves from the gaze and touch of men until their wedding night, and warned their daughters to remain guarded. Nothing was worse for a mother than to realize her daughters had grown and abandoned regard for what she had most desperately wanted to instill. Leila pulls a photograph from her purse. It was a risk to take it, but it was one of many. She wanted Seema to see proof. In it, Amira is smiling, her eyes dreamy, her lips glossy, and one finger playfully resting at the corner of her bottom lip. Her arms are showing. Her shirt is cut low, exposing her collarbone and the unmistakable line of her breast. The girl did not know what she was suggesting when she mimicked the photographs of models and actresses in magazines, but it was clear to any viewer. "We are lucky."